You're listening to JSCN, radio for the Jewish small communities.
And I'm Ed Horwich, and this is JSCN Talk, the podcast for Jewish small communities and anybody who's interested in Jewish topics and Jewish life. Can you believe it? We've reached the season finale, episode 19, and what a finale it's going to be. Don't worry, season 2, news of that at the end of this podcast. What a season finale. Sal Litvak, remember him, the film director of When Do We Eat? Well, he's also known as the Accidental Talmudist. It all started with writing a piece for one of the LA Jewish newspapers and became a Facebook channel where he and his wife Nina talk Jewish learning and Jewish life to over a million followers. Yes, over a million followers on Facebook. This second conversation with Sal is just a roller coaster of emotion. But I started with something that we both share in common, and that's how we individually got more involved with our own Jewish communities. For me, getting involved in Jewish small communities started with my mother around about the time that she died. You had a similar kind of experience. Tell me about that.
Even more my grandmother, right? My grandmother was a hero who kept my mother alive as a baby in a concentration camp. I mean, we all know how difficult it is to raise a baby anywhere at any time. Now imagine it in a concentration camp. And she took my mother as an infant. My mother was born in 1944. So my grandmother was Magda. My mother is Kati. And Magda kept baby Kati alive in Theresienstadt. Her husband, Imre, was taken from her and perished at Dachau concentration camp. And then after the war, my grandmother was very happy for all of the people who had lost their spouses and then were, you know, started again and recreated family and started from those ashes. But for my grandmother, there was only Imre. He was her beshert, her soulmate. And she would basically wait for the rest of her life to be reunited with him. She was not a morose, you know, unhappy, sort of depressed saint type of personality. She was very spunky and funny and outgoing. But she was just waiting to be reunited with her beshert. And in the meantime, she would pour all of her love and soul and resources into her only child, her daughter, Kati. And then eventually, when my mother married my father, Agustin Litvak, whom she met in Chile, then they had two boys, my brother and me, and Magda just continued to pour that love into her grandchildren. And eventually, we were there at her passing in 1997, and it was a very, very powerful experience. She was 89 years old, and ultimately it was melanoma that took her, but she lay in that bed and I was right beside her and she took that last breath. It was unmistakable. You know, my mother sort of was wailing and my brother was crying and I was crying, but something pulled my attention away from my grandmother's face and into the center of the room. Like the air in the room seemed to shimmer and grow bright and then brighter. And then some kind of like opening formed there in the middle of the room. And I looked through it and I could see my grandmother, not as she lay there racked with cancer, but as I knew her and, you know, this wonderful grandma. And she was moving away from me and towards something. And then I saw that it was towards someone. And looking over her shoulder, I saw him, my grandfather, who not only I never met him, but my mother never met him. I mean, he was taken away before she was born. But we had photographs of him. And I thought, oh my gosh, this is it. She's been waiting for 53 years to be reunited with her beshert. We all knew that about her. And now this is that moment. And she doesn't want to go. She seemed reluctant, like, and I was like, what's going on? Why would she not want to go? And then I realized you know, she's an old lady, and he's that same young, handsome man that she last saw in 1944. And she felt like he's not going to want me because I'm this old lady. But he reached out, he pulled her to him, embraced her, and the light got brighter, and then she was young again, like the last time they had been together. And it was like a total Hollywood movie. I mean, they're embracing and kissing, and then the lights got super bright and they were gone. And my mother and my brother are still crying, and I'm there with this tremendous grin plastered on my face, even as the tears are you know, falling down from my eyes. And I just couldn't believe what I had seen, and everything that I guess I suspected about this upper world, this spiritual world, I had just witnessed it. And this is not an unfamiliar scene. I mean, a lot of people have seen something like this. And even in the Torah, we find the words that when somebody dies, they're gathered unto their people. We usually find those words for Abraham and for Moses and for Aaron. And that's what I had seen. You know, she had been gathered unto her person. And it changed my life. I mean, until that moment, I knew I was Jewish, but I was very unconnected with Judaism. Sadly, because I always considered myself a spiritual person, and I thought Judaism was not spiritual. But when I returned to LA, my grandmother died at my parents' house in Bethesda, Maryland. When I returned to LA, I wanted to honor my grandmother. I went to synagogue, maybe for the first time in my life, where it didn't feel like a chore, a place that I was being dragged to. And then I had another very powerful experience, feeling like, you know, I'd been gone for so long, and then I finally came home, and realizing that, you know, the Judaism that had sort of turned me off when I was young, that boring, you know, chore-oriented Judaism is not Judaism. It's just, you know, one corner of Judaism. But if one is seeking a connection with the divine and with the souls of the ancestors and to be part, you know, the longest running and deepest spiritual current in the world, then one should look in the tradition. And that's when I started learning, and eventually that would lead to becoming the accidental Talmudist.
So how long before that connection with Judaism became that strong that you decided you wanted to go public with what you do now?
Well, what happened was, so then I reconnected, and I started essentially shul shopping, right, looking for a spiritual home within the Jewish community. And we're very blessed in LA that there's so many choices. I mean, there's just so many synagogues, so many streams of Judaism, so many wonderful teachers. And I started looking around and looking for the right teachers for me. And I took classes with many different rabbis. And every rabbi would sooner or later mention the Talmud. And, you know, as somebody who had at this point been an English major at Harvard and a law student at NYU and a lawyer briefly before I went to film school. But even at film school, I made a historical drama about Henry VIII. So I was somebody who was always drawn to sources, you know, to look it up, figure it out for yourself, read the books, get in there. And so all these rabbis, sooner or later, they would mention the Talmud. And I would think, okay, the Talmud, that seems to be the source. There's the Torah, clearly. I'm familiar with the Torah. But to understand the Torah, you seem to need to get in the Talmud. So I want to read the Talmud, but I didn't know what the Talmud was. And it seemed to be, in addition to being, it certainly seemed to be full of wisdom, but it seemed to be some kind of mysterious thing. And, you know, I would go to there's a Jewish bookstore that's well known here in LA. It's called the Mitzvah Store. And I'd go in there to get a gift or a book, and then I would see it. Okay, there's the Talmud, 73 volumes.
A big undertaking.
Yes. It looks like three Encyclopedia Britannicas. If you have older listeners, they know what that is. Young people don't know. But it certainly seemed to be impenetrable. I said, okay, that must be a huge collection of Jewish wisdom. I didn't go to yeshiva. I don't speak Hebrew. I wouldn't know where to begin. And I'd heard that in terms of Kabbalah, you're supposed to be, 40 before you get into that. Maybe for the Talmud, you have to be a certain age or you have to be a rabbi. I just somehow surmised that I wasn't even allowed to get into the Talmud. And so every time I would see all those books, I would think, I'd like to read that. It must be full of wisdom, but I wouldn't know where to begin. I don't really know what it is, and I'm probably not allowed. So I would walk away intimidated. What I really was intimidated. And repeat a dozen times. And then one time, I was in that store again for the umpteenth time, looked at those books, started to walk away, intimidated, and then thought, this is ridiculous. They're just books. There must be a book one. I'll get that and see what it's like. I figured out book one of the Talmud is Brachos. I found Brachos, blessings, and I took that volume to the counter, and the kid at the register said, oh, you're doing Daf Yom. And I said, what's Daf Yom? And he looked at me like this. So for your listeners, you can say I lowered my glasses, or he lowered his glasses at me as if to say, are you kidding me? And I thought, oh, Daf Yom is a code. If you don't know the code, you're not allowed to read the book. And now he knows that I don't know the code, and he's got to get rid of me, and this is awkward and embarrassing. How do I get out of here? And he said, Daf Yomi is a schedule. It's a program where people around the world read the entire Talmud, everyone on the same schedule. Daf Yomi means page of the day. So it's one page a day. Mm-hmm. If you read the Talmud one page a day, it takes 7.5 years to complete. And everyone embarks on it together. And today is day one. So I happened to buy book one of the Talmud on day one of a 7.5 year cycle. And for a spiritually minded person like me, I said, oh, okay, Hashem, I get the message. You want me to do Daf Yomi. The odds against this are so crazy long that it can only be a sign. And so I started doing Daf Yomi. And, the people who are normally doing Daf Yomi, they went to yeshiva for many years. And they already have a tremendous background in these books. I had nothing. So I was just lost for so much of the time. And for 3 years, I just sort of plodded forward alone. I knew you're supposed to go to a class, a shir. But when I had tried to do that, they said it was in English, but the rabbi who taught this Talmud class, every other word that came from his mouth was either in Hebrew or Aramaic. And so I had no idea what he was saying. But doing it on my own with Art Scroll, which is not just a translation, it's an elucidation. It's like having a great, great teacher presenting you the material with many additional notes in addition to the classic commentaries. And, so it's about an hour a day, every day, your wedding day, Yom Kippur, you're having an operation. It doesn't matter. You have to do your daf. And I don't know if I would have stayed with it if God hadn't put that book in my hand on day one of the cycle, but he did. And so I did stay with it. And after about 3 years, we happened to move. And in my new neighborhood, it was a shir being taught literally a couple blocks from my house. I said, let me try it again. Maybe this guy will speak more in English. And I went to this shir, and the rabbi started speaking. And no, every other word from his mouth was jargon. It was Hebrew or Aramaic. But having done this on my own with Rabbi Art Scroll, as it were, for the 3 years, now I could follow it. I could absolutely follow it. And so it was just a great, emotional and intellectual adventure into the heart of Judaism. And I stayed with it now along with the other guys in the class. And after 7.5 years, I completed the cycle. And let me just mention that the completion was this incredible thing called the Siyum Hashas. So the completion of reading the 7.5 year cycle was celebrated in a football stadium, a giant stadium in New Jersey. And there were literally 93,000 Jews in that stadium celebrating this uninterrupted wisdom tradition that goes all the way back to Moses at Sinai and even further back to Abraham. You know, I could not help but think that 70 years ago, you know, Nazis had filled stadiums celebrating that they were going to burn our books and burn us and wipe the Jews off the face of the earth. And those, I hesitate to call them people, but those individuals are gone from the face of the earth. And here we were dancing a hora, 93,000 strong, and celebrating that wisdom tradition. And I just felt so close to my grandmother then. And to my grandfather that I never met. I just knew that they were with us that night. And then I started writing about my experiences and about the joy and meaning that I had found and was finding in our tradition. And it started as a blog at the Jewish Journal of Los Angeles called The Accidental Talmudist. And if you have a blog, you should have a Facebook page. And the Facebook page really took off. I enjoy using Facebook for this holy purpose of sharing our ancient.
Yeah, you have, what is it, a million followers now on Facebook?
We have, yes, Accidental Talmudist on Facebook has a million followers in over 70 countries. It really is a community. And, you know, I feel that we're elevating social media. Social media so often gets slammed for, you know, for being a place for trolls and other misinformation. But here's a really holy use of social media to share this wisdom. The Jews have been instructed for millennia to be a light unto the nations, but we've also been persecuted so badly for millennia that we've tended to keep that wisdom to ourselves, you know, just to keep our nose down and stay alive. But if we're truly going to be a light unto the nations, I think we have to share that wisdom. And that is our mission at Accidental Talmudist.
And if you want to know more about the Accidental Talmudist and see what the fuss is all about with Sal Litvak, very easy. Just go onto Facebook and search for Accidental Talmudist. Sal and Nina do lots of different sessions, many of them live. They've got lots of guests in the studio, music, live broadcasts, even from inside a synagogue, seeing what their local shul does. Sal even broadcasts his own son's bar mitzvah, the calling up during the week. I can guarantee you will enjoy what you see. Now, thank you so much for staying with me for season one of JSCN Talk. Coming up, like I say, season two, we start off in a lovely, lovely conversation, about a four-way conversation with a project that JSCN is partnering. We are partnering British Jews in the First World War. That is a project all about recording the stories and the involvement of the Jewish community in the First World War, because we really got involved. We really felt so loyal to Britain, and everybody made an effort to take part in the war. And we want to record and keep those stories for posterity. So JSCN is part of that, making links with Jewish small communities. And I talk with Charlotte and Rodney and Alan about the project. Episode 1 of Season 2, that's where we're going. Now, here's another opportunity. Would you like to be a part of JSCN Talk? Not just listening on the other end, but actually making a JSCN Talk podcast? Well, you can. If you've got something like a smartphone, you do not need any fancy equipment. You can tell us your story. To start the ball rolling, just send me an email to hello@jscn.org.uk or use the contact form on the website, the Jewish Small Communities Network website. Just Google it and you'll get straight to there. And we really look forward to you being part of JSCN Talk. So send me an email, hello@jscn.org.uk. Once more, thank you so much for listening. I really do appreciate it. And I look forward to bringing you lots more stories from Jewish small communities and about Jewish life of all descriptions. I'm Ed Horich, and this is JSCN Talk, the podcast for the Jewish small communities.